Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars and will be influencing all our futures.
Today, I'm talking to Jess Morgan. Now, Jess is earlier on in her career and is going to talk to you about getting through life as a trainee doctor and how actually maybe it's more flexible than you might think. So, Jess, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So, Jess, do you want to start by just taking us through your career so far, and we'll see where that takes us?
Yeah, so I always knew I wanted to be a doctor from probably the age of about 9. I was that kid in the playground who rushes over to someone the second they've grazed their knee, you know, those wet, soggy paper towels that have the art of healing anything. So I think it was in me from a really early age. Nobody in my family was a doctor. But there was something between the marriage of kindness and compassion and empathy with science. I loved biology. I had a lesson, I think I must have been about 15, when the biology teacher brought in a cow's heart, and I was just blown away. It was the best thing I'd ever seen. And so I arrived at medical school perhaps slightly naively, but very, very enthusiastically.
So you had no role models that you can think of? You're just, what was it, the telly? Why did you say, this is for me?
My granny says that it was because her father was a doctor and it was in my genes. I never met him. But I did like ER, I suppose. But no, I had an elbow injury through gymnastics when I was 15. And so was really fascinated by that. I had appendicitis when I was 11. And I lived in France at the time, and it was done under sort of sedation and an epidural. And so I woke up towards the end, and the surgeon was showing me my appendix as they were sewing me up. And again, I was like, wow, this is incredible. So I think it was just lots of little things that spurred me on.
Gosh, so not parental pressure like it is with some people. Sorry, I interrupted you. So when you were at medical school?
Yeah, so I think I was very, very ambitious, very driven, and very conscientious, always had to be doing the right thing and have all my sort of work done on time. And I think in medicine, there's this culture that breeds achievement, and success is measured by achievement. So that for me, it was very much about doing well. I had to do well in my exams. I had to get publications and prizes, and somehow the more of that I did, the more validated I felt. My tutors liked me. And I used medicine as a little bit of a crutch. I literally lived and breathed it. It became my passion. And I knew quite early on that I wanted to do pediatrics. I love children. I spent my medical school pediatric placement in the playroom, just basically watching children and learning from observation, playing Hungry Hippos and Guess Who with the kids. Sort of from there grew this love of children and young people.
No other specialty ever appealed to you?
No, I think when I did my surgery rotation at med school, I went through a brief period of thinking, oh, wouldn't it be cool to be a surgeon? But no, not really. I was always a paediatrician. Probably because there is still a large part of me that is a child that hasn't yet grown up. And I do love some of my adult friends say, you know, oh, Jess, you are just such a big kid. And maybe to be a paediatrician, you need a bit of that.
OK, so, I mean, it's interesting because some parts of paediatrics have actually got the most horrendous on-call responsibilities. Well, was that something that you were aware of?
That is a very good question. I don't think I was. I think I was very naive at that stage in my training, and I did think, oh, paediatrics is going to be working in a lovely children's hospital with aquariums and, you know, lots of games and playrooms, and I'll be able to sweep in and make everything better. And obviously the reality of paediatrics is not that. So there was a bit of an eye-opener fairly early on in my training, actually. But there is so much positivity that comes from looking after children and young people, creating those partnerships and seeing children get better, that on balance, certainly early on in my career, I could manage that.
Okay. Tell me about the highs and the lows and the bumps in the road.
So I think the early stage of my career, I just carried on 110 miles an hour. Every single extra shift that needed covering, every project that came my way, every research opportunity, I just took it with open arms. And it wasn't until the birth of my children, really, that things began to become a little bit more challenging. I had lived quite a sort of, I don't know, selfish is the wrong word, but my life was quite self-centered. There was only me that I needed to think about, my career aims. And suddenly I had these two small children who had to come first. And trying to juggle that and finding my identity, I was no longer the doctor that I had strived to be. I couldn't be that doctor who stayed late all the time, who dedicated herself solely to paediatrics. And I really started to feel quite lost. Some of that came with becoming a less than full-time trainee, I think, and having, you know, all of the sort of pressures of home. But some of it also came from my mental health, which really began to take a sort of turn for the worse around the time my second daughter was born.
Right. So that's quite a difficult thing to admit, quite a difficult thing to talk about, really, because we don't normally do that. Although, you know, talking to a lot of the women that I've interviewed in this podcast, the whole thing of having children and working is quite a thing, an unwritten thing. So if you don't mind, tell us a little bit more about that and how it affected you.
Yeah, I completely agree. We don't talk about this. And actually, if anything, when I was a junior trainee, I would look at the sort of more senior doctors, generally registrars, generally women who would work less than full time. And I was judging them without realizing that I was judging them. And I was thinking, oh, you're not very committed. You're leaving on time. Why are you not staying late? And then I became that person and I couldn't stay late because my child was going to be left at the nursery doorstep. And that came with a huge amount of guilt and shame. And I think when I had my second daughter, I developed postnatal depression and I was quite unwell. I was started on medication and I remember going to the pharmacy and handing over my little green slip and thinking, oh my gosh, I am a doctor and I am now on antidepressants. Like, this doesn't happen. What kind of a doctor am I? I shouldn't be working. And suddenly stepping onto the other side, it does. It brings a huge amount of shame because we don't talk about this. And so I disclosed this to the consultant that was in charge of the trainees, and I sort of explained what had happened. And I said, I don't really think that I should be doing my on-call on my second day back at work after everything that's been going on. I've never worked in this hospital before. And circumstances were such that I was handed the crash bleep for a tertiary paediatric hospital 2 days after being back at work, and I literally broke. And it was the beginning of a spiral of badness, basically. And I think where previously compassion and empathy had been probably my strongest point and a real positive strength that I had, all of that was replaced with this bitterness and resentment and dread. I was falling asleep at traffic lights. I was constantly just irritable and frustrated, and I just hated the NHS. I hated everything that it stood for. I hated seeing patients. I'd feel angry at them for turning up on the paediatric assessment unit. And this was, I don't know, I was a shell of the doctor I used to be. But on the face of it, clinically, I was still very competent. I was still taking on projects. I was organizing and setting up a mentoring scheme for our region. I was still working incredibly hard and putting on this face and pretending that everything was okay. But inside, I was really, really struggling.
So what happened?
So I was very, very fortunate that I had a brilliant supervisor. And he said to me one day, Jess, I need to talk to you. I need to label you as a trainee in difficulty, because if I do that, then you'll get the help that you need. And I just remember thinking, like, what? I'm being black marked trainee in difficulty, and the shame and the failure that comes with those three words. But he was right. I mean, I got the support that I needed. I got a mentor through the professional support unit, and I sort of got occupational health involved. But by this point, it was too late, and I was already really quite sick. And, you know, there's a fine line between, you know, sort of stress and burnout and mental illness. And I think I really had tipped sort of right to the very end of mental illness. And I sort of staggered on for a little while. You know, my clinical competence was never in question, and I was very fortunate about that. But I do look back and I think, gosh, it was probably an error just waiting to happen. But this stigma really gagged me, and I felt so ashamed for having to reach out. But in the end, I saw a psychiatrist and he signed me off work. And I remember sitting in his office while he was writing on his little piece of paper, and I was crying because I just kept thinking about all the patients that I was letting down and all of my colleagues that I was burdening with this extra work. And at no point in that consultation did I think about myself. At no point did I think, oh my gosh, I'm really ill and I need some help and support. I was just, we don't teach each other to do that. We don't look out for ourselves. And so when you really need to, it turns out you don't know how. So I was signed off for 3 weeks, and 3 weeks turned into 11 months. And I got worse before I got better. I was convinced that I could never possibly be a doctor again. Who would want me? Why could I, you know, how would it work? But I was very fortunate, and I had an incredible mentor and a supervisor who really kind of listened and tried to understand what I needed. And I did go back. I went back, had a phased return, and went back as a supernumerary trainee for a year. But the system was very, very rigid. And as a trainee, it was very difficult. I felt like I was trying to jump through hoops that, you know, I wasn't really yet well enough to do, for example, nights and irregular shift patterns and things. And so I kind of got to the point where I had a very, very difficult decision to make, probably the most difficult decision I've ever made. And I basically decided to leave medicine.
Gosh. So how did that feel?
I think at the time, it was anger. I felt like I had no other choice, that this system was sort of forcing my hand a little bit. You know, like I said, that the individuals were all very kind and very compassionate, but it was the system that was struggling to accommodate my needs. And the point at which I left, I jumped straight into a different career very, very quickly, not really giving myself time to think. And I started a primary teacher training course, a PGCE. And I remember pushing my stethoscope to the back of a cupboard. I was just like, I'm never going to need this again. And I bought myself some fancy teacher's stationery, and I thought, it's fine, I'm going to be a teacher now. I won't need my stethoscope ever again. And so I started my PGCE. Oh, my word. I mean, you know, I thought I was a good teacher in medicine. People used to tell me, you're great at teaching, Jess. And whoa, it turns out I really wasn't. The learning curve on that PGCE course was exponential. And COVID happened during that year. So my course was cut short. And a bit like medical students, they needed teachers. So they fast-tracked us through. And it came to the following September and I had my own class. And it was very challenging. But I learned so much. So much that makes me a better pediatrician as well. I had some incredible children. I was teaching 6 and 7 year olds. And, you know, I mean, these are children who hadn't been to school for 6 months, who didn't really know how to read and write properly. And I mean, it sort of blows my mind a little bit that that was a chapter in my life. It feels quite long ago now. But I quite quickly missed medicine.
Interesting. What did you miss about it? Because it sounds like an extraordinary experience and it's still helping people.
Yeah, it is. I think a little bit like in medicine, education is in a bit of a dire situation, and you know, the priorities of schools are dictated by higher priorities. And so in many ways, my values felt slightly misaligned with the values of the school, perhaps. And there was a lot of tick boxing, jumping through hoops. It was all about assessments and attainment, which in my eyes, just after a pandemic, wasn't what was right for those children. And so again, I found myself feeling slightly out of kilter morally with what I was trying to do with these kids. And I missed the unbelievable privilege that we have to be part of people's lives in medicine, one that we just do not appreciate. You know, families, when they are at their very, I don't know, their most vulnerable, they need us. And we are welcomed with open arms into that, with a trust that, you know, is just unimaginable. And I think I also missed the teamwork. Again, not something that I had appreciated when I had it, but that belonging that comes with working with a multidisciplinary team, the problem solving, the intellectual challenge. I don't know, medicine was my identity. And it wasn't until I no longer had it that I realised that.
Gosh, and had been your identity since you were very small.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, what did you do?
So I ended up, I finished that year as a year two primary teacher, and then I decided to take a year out. And so rather than jump straight back into something else, I thought, look, I really need to give this some proper thought. And I had a little bit of careers coaching and tried to really delve deep into what my values are and what is important to me as a person, as a mother, as a doctor, as a pediatrician, because there are so many ways to be a doctor, and things that I had never really considered before. And so I, during this time, developed this sort of passion for doctors' mental health and workforce wellbeing. And I began to share my story. And I think through sharing my story, people connected. Because I suppose my story is not that different from many people's stories. We all have a vulnerability. We just don't talk about it.
And so getting closer up to the present, how did you get back to feeling like a doctor again? Or perhaps you always had?
No, that's a really interesting question, because I'm not sure whether I do yet. There is something about whether I feel legitimately able to use the word doctor, because I'm not clinically working. And up until the point at which I left, being a doctor in my mind was all about ward work and clinic work, and those were the doctors that I was surrounded by. When it came to returning last year, I did a clinical attachment in my local DGH for a few months, but there is no scheme, no national funding, no scheme for returning doctors. And although the NHS is hemorrhaging staff and we have vacancies everywhere, there is unfortunately no way at the moment of supporting those who want to return. And so I'm relying on the sort of kindness, once again, of individuals that I know and have met in my previous career. But the reality is that I am not in a position to return to training. So I can't do irregular shifts. I can't do nights at the moment. That might change in the future. But if I were to return to clinical medicine, it would be as a SAS doctor. And I am a firm believer that at present, the SAS role does not have parity of esteem with the training ladder. And that is something that I am really passionate about changing. But I want a role that has clinical elements, but also that has leadership, that provides me with the space to do this work, to be a sort of a mover and a shaker and a changer. And it's difficult to carve that out at the moment. So at Christmas last year, I applied for a job that came up at the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, which is working in the sort of workforce wellbeing space, working on a project called Thrive Paediatrics, which is about creating regional communities of paediatricians that come together and share their experiences and kind of begin to collaborate and reflect on how we can activate change and actually improve the systems and the cultures within which we work to improve our working lives. So that's where I am now. Will I be in this space forever? I hope in one way or another, but I hope there will also be other elements to my job. And I hope that I will feel able to say, I am a doctor again.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the difficulties that people have with flexibility. I often say that the NHS was created for the 1950s male, and it hasn't quite caught up with the needs of today's women. Well, fantastic story. Well done. I just want to ask you a little bit about your family. So you have two little girls, you've said. How did all that hang together when you weren't well? I mean, it's hard enough working as a doctor doing shifts and having all of those responsibilities. But if you're not well, in addition, how do you cope with all of that?
You know what? Thank you for asking me that, because I don't think anyone's ever asked that before.
I hope it's not too intrusive.
No, it's not intrusive at all. It's a really lovely question. And I think it really hits home, because it was very, very challenging. So my girls are now 10 and 7, but at the time when I was sort of unwell, they were closer to sort of, you know, 3 and 1 and around that age. I'm very, very fortunate that my husband is incredible, and he has an unbelievable understanding and sort of support for me. He works very long hours, so it was challenging. Whilst I was off...
Is he a doctor? Sorry to interrupt. Is he a doctor?
No, he's not. Right. He's not. I mean, he might as well have an honorary degree with the amount that he's heard from me. But no, he's not a doctor. But it got to the point where whilst I was off sick, and in order to have the sort of headspace to recover and then facilitate trying to go back to medicine, we employed a nanny. And that was something that financially was obviously a big commitment, but it was the only thing that was really going to make it work, because in order to get back to work, I needed to have the headspace to be able to focus on that and not have to deal with the juggling of all of the other things. I think for me, and probably for a lot of mothers in medicine, each of the elements of my life on their own, I can deal with absolutely fine. It's when you put them all together and you're trying to hold everything in mind alongside when they've got the dentist appointment and, oh my goodness, it's own clothes day tomorrow. And it's that. And so by having a nanny for that year, it did allow me a little bit more space to focus on work.
Yeah, I can remember thinking that there needed to be at least 5 people who were fit, well, functional and able to do their own jobs for me to be able to get to work every day. And I often felt quite irritated that not everybody was in that position.
Yeah.
I think that's quite common.
Yes, definitely. And I think it's also not something that we really talk about. And I do catch up with my girlfriends now who are, you know, pediatric consultants, and over a glass of wine, we do have a whinge about the mental load that we carry and how we juggle it all, because it's such a familiar story for many women. And I'm not saying that men don't carry it as well, because my husband is amazing and he helps a lot. But it is hard.
Yeah, it is hard. Listen, Jess, that's been fantastic, a fantastic story to listen to. I just want to finish off by asking you whether there's any advice you might give, whether there's anything that you might say to people who are listening to this and thinking, gosh, you know, I resonate with a lot of that. What am I going to do?
Yeah, I think I would say that's okay. And that if you do resonate with this, or if you have had, you know, challenges during your career, speak to someone. For so long, I sort of hid my history of mental illness, like it was so shameful, like somehow the GMC would have me struck off. And I think we need to have these conversations to dispel those myths. And finding somebody to be real with and be vulnerable. And perhaps for the more senior leaders that might be listening, it's about daring to be vulnerable, daring to be that role model who takes the mask off and says, do you know what, I've had a really bad day, because that's incredibly powerful. And it gives people permission to do the same. And it's only through having these conversations that we're going to begin to really sort of shift culture.
Thank you, Jess. So that's been a really powerful and helpful conversation, I'm sure, to a lot of people. So thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.